welcome to the show. Good to have you. I got two huge true crime stories that have become political firestorms. And when I say political, yikes. So this is your network, right? Fair and balanced in the middle of both stories. But man, oh man, suddenly the politics have hit true crime. I am starting with at least a couple of stories that I think may be interesting to you if you like true crime and politics. The couple that's jailed in Mexico, they're from Michigan. Okay, they went to Mexico on vacation, and now they are in a maximum security prison, not even jail, in Cancun, of all places, the place we think is safe to go on vacation. Even if we're going to like a five-star resort, we wouldn't think twice about being nabbed in the airport by Mexican police and thrown in a Mexican prison over a timeshare dispute. You heard me. A civil dispute. So I got some developments here. Their congressman from their state, a Michigan congressman, has now made it down to Mexico. I've got a picture for you of him meeting with the ACOs today. I've got some updates for you on what happened during that meeting, and also a live interview coming in just a few moments with a close friend of the family to give you updates on what's going to happen next. And how about just the cautionary tale for all of us? Is it even safe to travel in Mexico anymore, given what has happened to the ACOs? Also, Rachel Morin, she went for a run, as many of us do. She never came home to her five children because she was raped and left in a drainage pipe, dead. And now, after months and months of searching for her killer, they have a suspect who happens to also be, and here are the politics, an undocumented immigrant. And so enter the political part of picking a jury. They picked that jury in lightning speed, but can that man get a fair trial? And even if you do not care, I have some reasons for why you should, why a fair trial is so critical, even in a case where you may despise the defendant. Okay, that's coming as well. And then I got a report today that is 200 pages long, and I've been waiting for it for quite some time, and I think you have been too. If you are upset about how Sandra Birchmore's life was lived and how she died, you should be. When she was just a young teenager, she was molested by three police officers in the program that she had joined. They were her mentors, but they had sex with her or sexual relations with her, and at least one of them, the one in the middle there, the one on the left there, Matthew Farwell, got her pregnant. The relationship with her went on for years, even though he had a wife and kids at home. So then suddenly when she got pregnant and then turned up dead in her apartment, six officers investigated and discovered that it was a suicide. By the way, I'm not a forensics expert, and I could have told you by looking at pictures it wasn't a suicide. And some of the officers on the scene weren't so sure either. In fact, didn't believe it. But yet, nothing to see here. Suicide. Well, they've been investigated. The entire police department. And the report has landed. And it's not just about those cops. It's about the Karen Reed trial, too. And another for good measure. And the biggest issue that I have is that there's nothing to see here. You may be upset about it, too. We're going to dig into it in just a moment. And then Wendy Williams has her defenders in like a Free Britney kind of movement. A whole bunch of people took to the streets in a Free Wendy movement right beneath her window. This happened in New York, also happened in L.A. And if you think this is really good for Wendy's effort to release her or get herself released from a guardianship, do I have news for you? That lady just hired one of the biggest guns in the legal profession. And when I say big guns, I mean someone who's represented A-Rod, Michael Jackson, even the president. Wendy's ringer will be revealed in just a moment. All right, so picture, if you will, a town of about 25,000 people, and then suddenly that town has a suspicious death. There is a rush to judgment and claims of a widespread police cover-up. Eyebrows would be raised, yeah? And then if that town had two suspicious deaths, you would imagine the headlines would be everywhere. Now brace yourself. If that town had three in 4 years, it is time for a full-scale independent investigation, which is exactly what just wrapped up in Canton, Massachusetts. If Canton, Massachusetts sounds familiar, it should. We have talked about it a lot on this show. It's where Karen Reed is accused of killing her police officer boyfriend with her SUV back in January of 2022. And it's where a young mother-to-be named Sandra Birchmore was found hanged in her apartment the year before in February of 2021. Canton's third suspicious death has gotten far less coverage than the other two. A man named Craig Casey was found dead in someone's yard more than an hour after police cleared the scene of a car crash. In all three cases, the Canton police were suspected and or accused of some level of conspiracy or misconduct, which prompted an investigation, more like an audit, of the Canton Police Department by a Miami-based company called Five Stones Intelligence. If you have never heard of Five Stones Intelligence, I'm with you. I had not heard of it either. But it calls itself a Judeo-Christian principled intelligence agency and professional services firm, for what that's worth. Its staff includes former members of the DEA, the FBI, Secret Service, and local police departments who spent the past 4 months looking into the past decade of the Canton PD. And what did Five Stones Intelligence conclude in its 206-page report? Not much. No, really, not much. At least no serious wrongdoing on the part of the Canton police. Our national correspondent, Caitlin Becker, has been all over that report with a microscope, and she joins me now outside the Canton Police Department with two jobs tonight. Your first job is to tell me what is going on with this report, and your second job is to get me the F off a ledge.
Truly, Ash, I don't know if I can do number two there, because 200 pages I pored over this document looking for what went wrong, if there were any glaring missteps or problems, and I didn't see any, considering two of these cases that you talked about are two of the more high profile, of course, Karen Reed, one of the most high profile cases we've talked about, and they involved this huge audit that was called on by the residents of Canton in this picturesque town. I mean, even the police department behind me looks this beautiful Cape Cod building. And then you have these tragedies. Now, in the case of Sandra Birchmore, the audit really didn't reveal much. It came to not a lot of recommendations. I mean, her death initially ruled a suicide. Federal investigators came in, and now another officer in a nearby town is charged in her death. However, this audit says that all the protocols were followed. Now, just to point out here, something that I think needs to be said is that the audit was done to see if proper policing was followed during the investigations. It is not reevaluating the evidence. It is not looking into any forensics. It's not coming to any conclusion. But at least in the Sandra Birchmore case, it seems as though they're saying the Canton police followed all of their, you know, from A to Z, exactly what they should have been doing. There were a few recommendations, like photographing the scene in a different way and maybe having some oversight for the detective that ruled it a suicide. But I was shocked that there were no other recommendations or no other glaring problems really in either of these things. A lot more when we get into the John O'Keefe, Karen Reed instance.
Okay, well, I'm still on the ledge, and here's why I am so on the ledge with this report, Caitlin. To remind our viewers about Sandra Birchmore, she was like not even a teen. I think she was a preteen when she joined the Explorers group with the police. And, you know, that's the mentoring group. You're supposed to follow the police around and maybe become a police officer one day yourself. And multiple officers passed her around like a party favor. One of them eventually got her pregnant and had a long affair with her. He's up on murder charges, right? He is up on murder charges because pregnant Sandra Birchmore turned up dead. And the officers, I believe six of them, who responded to her apartment, all decided nothing to see here. It's a suicide, when it was very, very simple. But it took years in order for them to classify it was not a suicide and to charge the baby daddy, a cop, with the murder. I just can't see how there's nothing to see here in this report. Just give me one line on whether this report means anything, and then I'm going to get to Karen Reed.
For Sandra Birchmore, it really doesn't seem like it means a whole lot. But you have to remember in this instance, this is an audit done by the city of, you know, Canton. The federal investigators are the ones who are hammering this case for Matthew Farwell. They're the ones in charge. The federal investigators are the ones who had said there is something to see here. They pointed out that there were baby clothes in the apartment and a sonogram in the apartment, and that all signs indicated that she was excited about this baby. However, the one thing that this audit does also bring up is the fact that Matthew Farwell was identified by Canton police as being the last person in Sandra Birchmore's home. So it is it's kind of unfathomable that they did not come to some conclusion that some sort of misstep was made in that investigation to have gone from a suicide to a homicide, Ash.
Yeah, misstep. Holy cow. We see all his steps leaving the apartment that night on camera. Holy cow. Okay, so let's talk about Karen Reed, because this is still Canton Police Department. That's where her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, died in the snowbank. It was in Canton, so the police that responded were the Canton police. And I should say that Matthew Farwell is from the Stoughton Police Department, right? And so were those other awful men who did those things to Sandra Birchmore. But Sandra lived in Canton, and that's where her body was found. So there's the connection. So in the Karen Reed case, Caitlin, the audit focuses a lot on Karen Reed. It says there were some problems, quote unquote, and some missteps, quote unquote, but no conspiracy. And I just wonder if it's a coincidence or a conspiracy that this audit drops on day one of her trial. And what's going to happen when they actually bring this to the public, which I think is Saturday, this Saturday at 2 p.m. They're going to bring this, what I say is like potentially garbage, to a public hearing. Are they going to have to set up barricades and get police to police the police?
You know, we very well might see that on Saturday. Media will get their chance to ask those questions, but the residents of Canton, who are the ones who demanded this audit happen, they get their chance to ask their questions first. And when you're looking through the audit of the Karen Reed situation and the fact that this dropped the day the trial, the retrial began, it's hard not to look at this and consider the word conspiracy. And then you see the word conspiracy in the paperwork of this audit, saying that the auditors found no sign of any kind of conspiracy by Canton police. And of course, that is what Karen Reed's defense has been, that she is the victim of a conspiracy. Now, could that be problematic for the defense? Should prosecutors bring that into court? Absolutely. And I talked to a lawyer earlier today, a prosecutor in a large jurisdiction, and they said to me that absolutely, if Karen Reed's defense is going to bring up the conspiracy theory in court, it's very likely that they will bring in these auditors to rebut that. However, they did talk about a lot of missteps when it came to the investigation into John O'Keefe. And I think a really good defense attorney, and we know Karen Reed has them, is going to be able to string together a narrative that will say this investigation was botched. The Canton Police Department, according to this audit, was completely ill-equipped to handle, at least forensically, an investigation of this scale. There weren't evidence collection bags. They didn't photograph John O'Keefe's body there. They were collecting blood evidence in Solo cups. They were throwing other things in Stop and Shop baggies. They were not handled the chain of command. All of those things are the recommendations moving forwards that the Canton Police Department needs to do. But how that impacts the Karen Reed trial, I think, could perhaps benefit the defense. But Ash, what is so interesting with this audit? All that said, the Solo cups, they used a leaf blower in order to uncover evidence. The auditors call it resourceful, that yes, they were ill-equipped, they didn't have these things, but the officers on the ground, they said, were resourceful for using these methods. It was all they could do. So there's a lot to work with here, you know, when it comes to this. And it gets into the nitty-gritty of things that we saw at trial, the mirrored images with CCTV footage of the back of her Lexus, all of these things that her defense team pointed out. We do see parts of it in that audit.
Well, I don't fault the police for using what they have in a circumstance when they don't have anything. If they used the Solo cups, it was resourceful. If they got the leaf blower, That's all they had to try to process any kind of murder scene in that snowstorm. So I get that. Hey, Caitlin Becker, great work. Thank you. I am slightly off the ledge, but I think there's more to it in this audit that we're going to find out. Thank you for this. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Ash.
Okay, I want to bring in Robert D'Amico now because he is a retired FBI agent and he is founder of Sierra One Consulting. Why does that matter? Because Sandra Birchmore's supporters asked him to help as they tried to get it reclassified from a suicide to a murder. And as we all know, it has been. Rob, thanks for coming on. I couldn't wait to talk to you about this 200 plus page audit. What do you make of the fact that there's nothing to see here in two or three cases where there seems to be a lot to see here? Oh, my goodness. I think you have committed the mortal sin of not unmuting. And I do it all the time, so I will not fault you. But I will get you to unmute as quickly as possible.
Can you hear me now?
Thanks, Rob.
I think it's like you. You feel just empty. You feel like this is a vanilla, washed over audit that's going to come out. There's a couple things with it. An audit's not an investigation. If you go in and you have no police powers in that, you can, you're investigating if there's a conspiracy and you ask, well, is there a conspiracy? How many police officers do you think are going to openly talk about that? It's not going to happen. I think the resourcefulness is one thing, but like really a leaf blower at a crime scene, I can think of about 10 different ways to process that crime scene. And it's one of those things that you come back with, this is all your recommendations in these cases that are so bad. And again, Karen Reed, the conspiracy thing is needs to be investigated by a police department that has police powers that when you put them under oath, that they have to tell the truth or they're lying to another police officer. So I think that's an issue. And with Sanders' case, I mean, it is another police department. When you really look at the heinous part of that, three police officers sexually assaulted her, passed her around. And then the crime scene that you talked about, though, that was Canton. And again, you look at a crime scene like that, and it wasn't properly documented. And you walked in, and if you really thought that was a suicide, like, come on, are you kidding me type of thing? Like you said.
Yeah, I mean, I could have, without any forensic training, I could have easily at that crime scene seen the evidence that would have said, no, I think we've got a few more questions here than what might seem. First of all, she was hanging from a door handle, not even hanging. And I think her hyoid bone wasn't broken, which I think the medical examiner needs to give his head a shake. But let me ask you this quick question about Five Stones Intelligence. I read the bio, the one-line bio, a Judeo-Christian principled intelligence agency and professional services firm. Look, I go to church. I'm not anti-religion, but what the heck is a Judeo-Christian principled? Shouldn't it just be an intelligence agency and professional services firm? Like, this already makes me suspect.
It is. They were involved in some things I was in before in horse racing. I found their practices sloppy and you know, the way that they're like trying to do things was not on the up and up on a couple things that like it just questions me like who. Well, they are hired by the city. And it almost like when you read the intro of, you know, oh, they're so cooperative and then we appreciate their help. Well, you got to put that out there. So I think their credibility goes back to when you look at the cases and this is what they come out with. I think that hurts their credibility in the long run. Like you said, do you really trust them now when you look at a case like Karen Reed and you come out with a few recommendations and some of them are really basic. I mean, if they don't know how to process a crime scene and they're detectives, I think that goes to a further thing than just a couple policy changes.
Yeah, I guess I call myself or consider myself a Judeo-Christian, but I do not call this show Banfield, the Judeo-Christian crime show, because it doesn't play in to the quality or the content, as this shouldn't either. So I just get a weird feeling about that. Rob D'Amico, always good to have you. Thanks for doing this tonight.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, think you're safe when you hit that 5-star resort in Mexico? You might want to think again. An American couple has been nabbed by police at the Cancun airport over a timeshare dispute. And now they're locked up with murderers with no end in sight. But a U.S. congressman may be coming to the rescue. In fact, he landed and has met with them. I've got the full update on what happened and a friend of the family to give us the breakdown on all the new developments. That's next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation On The Go. I'm Leland Vittert. This is America's fastest-growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
I was drawn to cases that I have never seen before because, frankly, there is, not that many of them left because I've been doing this job a long time. But getting thrown into a maximum security prison over a timeshare dispute before any charges are even filed, assuming any crimes even occurred in the first place, that does not happen, not in America, but it is happening in Mexico. We've been following the plight of Paul and Christy Acao, a Michigan couple who flew to Cancun on vacation almost a month ago, 29 days to be exact. He is 58 and retired from the Navy, and she's 60 and a grandmother. But in the Cancun airport, the Mexican police descended on them and did this, arrested them and hauled them away. And why? Because of a business dispute. Just let me repeat that. A business dispute. The Acaos had been at war with a high-end resort that had sold them a timeshare. But the Acaos say the resort had not lived up to its end of the deal. The Palace Company says it's the other way around, claiming that the Acaos committed fraud. What is mystifying in this civil dispute is that Palace Resorts got the police involved, something you can do in Mexico. And now Paul and Christy are on night 29 in a hardcore Mexican prison. Prison with murderers and rapists. The company sent us a lengthy letter with its side of the story, which reads in part, in 2021, the Acaos were found to be in material breach of agreements after promoting and profiting from their benefits on social media, conduct explicitly prohibited under the terms they agreed to. I should note that American Express actually sided with the Acaos in their dispute, and they refunded much of the Acaos' money. But Palace Resorts say that that only made the situation worse and said this, quote, the Acaos later bragged about these chargebacks and encouraged others to follow suit via a Facebook group they operated, further compounding the damage. Again, that's pretty civil stuff to me anyway, but not in Mexico. Tonight, we have some of the first images of Paul and Christy Acao since their arrest. They are seen here meeting with Tom Barrett, a U.S. congressman from their home state of Michigan. He flew to Cancun today to try to help get them released. And later, Congressman Barrett posted this on Facebook. After landing in Cancun this morning, I traveled directly to the maximum security prison where Paul and Christy Acao are being held. I met with them personally for an hour, and I learned of the horrific conditions they are facing. Rubbled walls, overcrowded cells, toilets that don't flush, and disgusting food. This has left them scared, frustrated, and struggling to find hope. I assured them that I am doing everything I can to urgently secure their safe release. Following my meeting with Paul and Christy, I met with the president of Quintana Roo Supreme Court to expedite any relief that we can provide. Thank you to the U.S. State Department for their assets and support on the ground to end this family's nightmare, and I hope to have more to share soon. Joining me now live is Mallory Wilson, a close friend of the Acao family and their daughter, Lindsay. She also happens to co-host a true crime podcast called Buried Bylines. Mallory, thank you so much for being on. First question, you just saw the pictures. Those are the first pictures since the Acaos were arrested. You're close to this family. How do they look, and do you have any inside information about how they're doing?
They look much smaller. They definitely look like they've lost weight, muscle. I've never seen Paul look like that. And I know that Chrissy's lost about 25 pounds since being there. So she is much smaller. You can just see the life has kind of been drained from their faces. But I have to imagine that seeing Representative Barrett today was a good sign and a good feeling for them.
So tell me a little bit about what the congressman may have learned, because those were not televised. That was a photograph only. We don't have the audio of the meeting. What the congressman may have learned above and beyond what he wrote on Facebook and what he may have imparted on the Ikeos kids, your friend Lindsay and Lindsay's brother.
Yeah, so I think really what he's learning is what Lindsay's been shouting from the rooftops for weeks now, which is, you know, for the past month, they haven't been treated very well. They have been, Chrissy in particular, has been served food that she's uncomfortable eating. She's not sure if she's going to be allergic to it. She's been served fish despite telling them she's allergic to shellfish. The other day, I felt like it was the most heartbreaking update. Lindsay said, you know, her mom got to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and she was so happy about that. And that is just so heartbreaking to hear. And these are the types of the conditions that they've been living with.
Is there an update on the progress of getting them home?
I don't know if there's any update right now, but I do know within the last hour, Lindsay was talking to Representative Barrett, and I know that he is very much still working to bring them home.
I also know that the Ikeos, and I see what you're saying as I look at the photos of them, you know, another time, comparing these photos to the pictures today, they are significantly different. They look very, very different in these photos. And it does appear that they've lost a considerable amount of weight in 29 days. I mean, look at that. 29 days of being locked up in, again, a maximum prison. So the issue is that they have done everything they can to be public and reach out to even the president of the United States, Donald Trump. Do you know if the president has, do they have his ear? Does he know of this case? Has he made any overtures? Has Lindsay and her brother, have they had any success in trying to reach the top of the U.S. government?
I can say that I know that Representative Barrett has been in touch with President Trump, and I believe, to my knowledge, that he is aware of what is going on.
Do you have any idea if the Ikeos were given any warning at all that if they ever returned to Mexico, which they just did a month ago for a vacation, they'd be arrested in the airport? Because I just want to remind the viewers, this dispute was settled years ago. And so this is a return to Mexico when they were grabbed. Did they have any indication from the Mexican authorities that if they came back to Mexico, this would happen?
Absolutely not. I don't think there's any way that they would have gone to Mexico if they knew. And the palace swears that they sent them warnings and that they knew that this was going to happen. Those warnings were not received. They, I don't believe, were ever sent. I believe it was a full ambush and they wanted to catch them off guard.
Well, I'm not going to get into the litigation between the Ikeos and Palace Resorts because I don't think it matters. I think at this point that is a civil dispute that should be handled in a civil way. That's the way we do it in America. But it is a cautionary tale for so many people watching right now. Different countries operate in different ways, and garbage like this can happen to you even if you think you're going to a five-star resort like the Palace Resorts. Mallory Wilson, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. Keep us posted, will you?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Okay. And again, Mallory's podcast is called Buried by Lines. It's available everywhere. Still to come, yet another hot button murder trial with a newly seated jury. And I'm not talking Karen Reed. I'm not talking Lori Vallow. I am talking Rachel Morin, the mother of five who was brutally killed while out on a jog 2 summers ago in Maryland. Her alleged killer is an undocumented immigrant. Can he get a fair trial? Why, even if you don't care about that, you really should, especially if you want to see him guilty and locked up. Rachel's family attorney is next.
You're listening to Banfield on News Nation's audio stream. Available 24-7 on the News Nation app. Or just say, Alexa, play News Nation.
It's been almost 2 years since Rachel Morin was brutally raped and murdered on a Maryland hiking trail. And for months on end, her killer was on the loose. All we had to go on was this mysterious doorbell video from clear across the country. The man who committed sex assault here left his DNA at Rachel's murder scene, too. And when a suspect was eventually caught, it turned out he was in the country illegally. Now he's 2 days away from facing an American jury in an American courtroom, a jury that was just picked hours ago. When the public learned that he was an undocumented immigrant from El Salvador, the case went from true crime mystery to political firestorm. And maybe that's why the judge made it tough for the media to even consider jury selection, much of it happening behind closed doors. The judge is also barring the media from reporting or posting about the trial from anywhere inside the courthouse. That jury is about to hear and see a lot of unpleasant stuff. Rachel's murder was the stuff of nightmares. Here's Caitlin Becker.
August 5th, 2023 was like any other day for Rachel Morin. She left home for a walk on a popular nearby trail, the Ma and Pa Trail. A day later, her body would be discovered. The mother of five brutally raped and murdered. 10 months went by with nothing, no arrests, and no answers for Rachel's family.
That they really did care about our family, my daughter, that they were going to work diligently to find the person that murdered her. At one point, when things seemed like really bleak and hopeless, the lead detective said to me, he said, patience will win in the end.
And then a break. DNA evidence taken from Morin's body was put into a national database, and authorities got a hit. Their potential suspect was wanted in another attack on the other side of the country, a home invasion and assault on a young girl all the way in Los Angeles. What they needed now was a name. Police released this footage from the home invasion. The sheriff circulated a suspect sketch, and Morin's family had boots on the ground handing out flyers. But it was an unlikely tool that led investigators to their prime suspect. The FBI enlisted the help of a company specializing in forensic genetic genealogy. They identified Victor Martinez Hernandez, an illegal immigrant from El Salvador with a rap sheet. Back in his home country, the 23-year-old is wanted for murder. And in 2023, the same year of the attack on Morin and that young girl in L.A., he had not one, not two, but three run-ins with Border Patrol. Police ultimately arrested Hernandez more than a year after Morin's murder at a bar in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And on a day that had started out like any other for Rachel Morin, authorities alleged that Hernandez was lying in wait in a drainage ditch on the Ma and Pa Trail just waiting, looking for an opportunity to attack.
Opening statements are set for Friday, and the prosecutors want a life sentence without parole if guilty. I'm joined now by the attorney for Rachel Morin's family, Randolph Rice. Mr. Rice, thanks so much for being here. Has the family been briefed on what is about to happen in this trial, the kind of evidence, the kind of story that this crime presents? Do they know how bad this is going to get?
They really don't, because the prosecutors really hadn't told anybody anything because they didn't want to taint that jury pool. So the family really doesn't know much. They obviously, you know, have some ideas, but they really don't know the facts about what's going to be presented at this trial.
Well, I can understand that because, you know, jury tainting is a big issue with high profile cases. And this one became high profile even before it became politically high profile with an undocumented, visitor to this country. Do you think in that vein he can get a fair trial? I mean, just given the notion it is a high profile true crime story and it is a political nightmare, that is in the zeitgeist right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the past 2 days of jury selection have been about trying to find people who can be fair and impartial, that they can listen to the evidence, so they can look at the evidence and hear the witnesses and apply the law in Maryland and determine if he's guilty or not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
I ask that because I sometimes in my business, I see a term called stealth jurors. And for those who are watching right now who don't know what a stealth juror is, it's kind of what it sounds like. It's somebody who answers all the questions as though they can be fair and impartial, but really what they plan to do is get on that jury and make sure something that they want to have happen happens. Is there a concern about that in this case?
I haven't heard that, you know, and they certainly went through over a couple hundred different jurors in this case, asked them numerous questions. And so I'm hopeful that the judge, the state and the defense were able to weed out any of those type of stealth jurors.
And I sort of harp on this because it's important. In the climate we're in right now, there is a huge movement in this country against, you know, people who break into this country and are here illegally. And when they commit crimes, it gets even hotter in the news. In this particular case, if there's a problem with regard to that in the way the jurisprudence is carried out, that could lend itself to an appeal, which is why I say to anyone watching, even if you hate those who are undocumented in this country, you will want justice to prevail because if he's guilty, you want it to stick. Is there a concern in your mind, in the family's mind, that they get the best jury ever to make sure that whatever happens in that courtroom is the final result?
Yeah, the family's been very careful, Ashley, about making sure they didn't say too much before this trial. The prosecutors certainly warned them, and that was their concern from the prosecutor's standpoint, that they did get a fair jury to judge and determine if this case, you know, is applicable to the Maryland law.
Are you, I can't imagine what it's like to be you, actually, right now. Are you preparing them for what's going to happen in that courtroom? And next question after that is, do they plan to be in there for all of it?
You know, when the Mourns came in to see us a week after Rachel was found, we started preparing them then. And, you know, they certainly, I think, are ready, but they are going to be shocked. We've talked about how it's going to be difficult to see the images, to hear the testimony from the officers and the forensics. So I think they're ready, but it's certainly still going to be very difficult for them.
I think you all have your jobs cut out for you. Please, Mr. Rice, pass on our prayers and our best wishes to the family members. I don't envy them a little at all. I mean, this is just a really tough few weeks they're going to be going through. Thanks for being here, Randolph Rice. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ashley.
Look forward to seeing you again. And coming up, the plot thickens. And by plot, I mean the fog of truth. Each day, we're learning more and more about that shocking picture that was posted by Virginia Giuffre. She is the woman who brought down Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and Prince Andrew with accusations of sex trafficking. But what's the real story behind the bus crash that she said left her with just 4 days to live? There is a whole new twist, and it is next.
Tomorrow, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt joins Morning in America, talking tariffs, the president's latest moves, and what all Americans can expect next on Morning in America. Tomorrow, beginning at 6 a.m., 5 Central, only on News Nation.
Chris, I enjoy your show. While we may agree or disagree, we're never disagreeable, and I appreciate your points.
This is the place that respects all Americans.
Congressman, we're always welcome here.
News Nation, news for all Americans.
Virginia Giuffre posted that disturbing photo and cryptic message the other night. The only thing we knew for sure was that we didn't know everything. Turns out we knew barely anything. Giuffre, of course, is the sex trafficking victim who helped to bring down Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and made that there guy, Prince Andrew, a pariah with the royals. On Sunday, she claimed her car had been hit by a bus and that doctors had given her just 4 days to live. But police later said the crash was minor. Giuffre's spokeswoman said the post was never meant to be public. And now People magazine is reporting that Giuffre was and is the subject of a, quote, family violence restraining order, end quote, which she allegedly violated in February. She appeared in court 10 days before the accident, and People magazine says that she's due back in court in Australia, where she lives, a week from today. But there's more. Giuffre's representative just fired back at the People magazine report, telling E! News, and I quote, "Virginia looks forward to defending herself against this malicious claim. Virginia continues to be hospitalized in serious condition." So was this a private family sorrow gone mistakenly viral? Is Virginia at death's door? Or is there still a whole lot more we don't know about? Stay tuned. We'll stay on it. When you are a public figure stuck in a very public legal fight, it is great to have public support. Case in point, a street demonstration in support of Wendy Williams this week. But you know what's even better than all those people below her window? A take no prisoners lawyer. A lawyer who's defended everyone from Michael Jackson to Donald Trump and who isn't afraid of the spotlight. So guess who Wendy Williams just snagged in her fight to shake that three-year-old guardianship? We are talking to him next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the Go. I'm Chris Cuomo. This is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
There's no question Wendy Williams has always had her fans, but now she has super fans who may end up her heroes. They took to the streets, Free Britney style, demanding that Wendy be freed from the guardianship that she's been under for almost 3 years. This is what it looked like on the streets of New York this week.
We want Wendy free today!
The crowds were chanting right below Wendy's window because she is still stuck in a tightly controlled assisted living facility, one that she regularly calls a luxury prison. Look at her. She's loving it. But aside from the groundswell of all the public support beneath her window, Wendy may have just landed an ace in the hole in the way of a new hired legal gun. And by gun, I mean bazooka. If you follow true crime, you know this lawyer's name and you really know his former clients like A-Rod, Michael Jackson, even the president, Donald Trump. We heard the rumors, but here's what happened when we asked Joe Tacopina outright if he is officially on Wendy's team. Take a look.
But I am, yes, I am representing her. I'm a personal attorney right now. I will be entering the guardianship case one way or another, but it's a convoluted process, so the judge has to approve guardianship attorneys, and the last thing they want to do is see my face in that courtroom. So, but yes, I am representing her. I am the lawyer right now.
You heard it here first. It is official. Joe Tacopina will be fighting for Wendy. And he is one of the most powerful attorneys in the business. Let me put it this way. I'm in the business of true crime, and I would hire him if I needed him. So word to the other side. Do your homework. Joe, don't play.